it's time for Homegrown on 94.7 WPBC LP Charlottesville with your hosts Clinton Johnston and Leslie M. Scott Jones, Charlottesville's only radio show devoted to local arts. And now, here's Leslie.
Good morning, Sunday morning. Whether you're an art maker, an art breaker, an art faker, or an art partaker, welcome, because all are welcome, of course, to Homegrown, a show about local art. I'm here with the only Jones that the anti-drug advocates want to are actually down with, Leslie M. Scott Jones. How are you, Leslie?
I'm wonderful, Clinton. How are you?
I am well. It is nice to see you this morning.
Yes, you as well. I'm all dressed up today.
You are all dressed up, and I believe you actually have a place to go.
I do. For the third time in the past 3 days, I'm all dressed up and have somewhere to go.
You are a busy, busy bee.
Yeah, I am. I am. I am going to the Perfumed Pen Black Female Writers Luncheon this afternoon.
I really need to hear that name again.
Perfumed Pen Black Female Writers Luncheon.
That's it, ladies and gentlemen. I'm done. I'm done. I'm out of here. That's just... Nothing that I can say today can top that. The Perfume Pen Black Female Lunch. Okay, all right. And why, pray tell, are you going to the Perfumed Pen Black Female Luncheon, Leslie?
Well, I was invited because of my novel. So it's a group of black female writers.
Because of your navel?
Novel.
Oh, your novel.
Novel. Book. Bookends. Available on Amazon, Google Play, Barnes & Noble, go get it. But anyway, I was invited. It's going to be a group of black female writers, and we're all going to get together and read from our work and have a little lunch and have a good time.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, I hope that's a wonderful thing.
I'm excited.
You should be.
Yes, a room full of wonderful, intelligent artistes. I can't wait.
Great. Gracious.
I know.
This is the life of the artist, ladies and gentlemen. You know what I'm excited about?
What are you excited about?
Today's show.
I am too. We've got some really great guests today.
Some wonderful guests. But getting into it, just to make sure our excitement is safe.
Right.
And sanitary.
Exactly.
For the general populace.
Uh-huh.
For the local crew.
Yes, those little ones.
For those little ones. And the even littler ones who they're beating up right now. Because I know how siblings work, ladies and gentlemen. Oh, yes, I do.
Mm.
Oh, yes, I do.
Yes.
We start the way we usually start with our parental advisory. A warning out there, we may at one time, at some time in the show, we certainly will try not to. Oh, goodness gracious, we'll try not to. But at some time in the show, we may say the word Aboriginal. Aboriginal.
That's a loaded word right there.
It's a loaded, loaded word.
Yeah.
So many syllables percolating, bubbling against each other seductive manner.
It's always the ones with a lot of syllables that get us in trouble, isn't it?
Yeah. You'd think the FCC would be more concerned with those multisyllable words, but I think it speaks to the intelligence of your average FCC person that they haven't quite graduated beyond one or two syllable
there you
words.
Go. As Clinton straightens his imaginary tie.
His imaginary tie. Thinks about the FCC listening. Well, if the current head of the FCC is angry at anything that I say, he can go back to being a shill and a lobbyist for the big communications corporations.
There you go, because that's where he came from.
There you Alrighty. Go. Suck it. Anyway.
Oh!
All right. Let's go on to our first guest.
Yes!
We are pleased and proud to have with us Henry F. Scarrett. He's an art historian and a curator with the University of Pittsburgh. He was just recently here bringing an exhibit to the Kluge-Ru Aboriginal Art Museum. Henry F. Scarrett, how are you doing, Henry?
I'm great. Thank you for having me.
We're so pleased to have you. Thank you for being here. So,
great. It's a great thing to do Sunday morning, come and talk about some art.
Indeed, that's what we think,
right? Because we do it every week.
We have the best Sunday mornings ever.
That's right. We get to talk to the most amazing people every week.
So, speaking of art, tell us about the art in this exhibit that you just brought to the Kluge-Ru Aboriginal Art Museum.
All right. So, this is a very, very special exhibition. The exhibition is called Yimaduwara Artist of the River, and it's a career survey from a very elderly Aboriginal woman named Lunganan. So I'll say that again because that's a complicated name. Her name is Lunganan. And Lunganan, well, you know, the first thing that tends to surprise people about Lunganan is that she was born around 1910. So if you do the math quickly in your head, that means that she's about 105 years old.
Holy smokes.
Still painting, still in great health, doesn't take any medication. But the even more amazing thing is that she didn't even start painting until 2004. So she was well into her 90s by the time she first picked up a brush. So, you know, as a retrospective or a career survey, you know, it documents a pretty short, sharp career from a quite, you know, significant senior woman.
What was this woman doing for the 90 years before she decided to start painting?
You know, that's a good question. So, you know, part of the answer to that is opportunity. That, you know, when Lunganan was born in 1910, the cattle industry had spread through the Kimberley region where she lives. She lives in the remote northwest of Western Australia. So from the 1850s onwards, these cattle barons sweep through the north, and what happens is, you know, they don't really show a lot of respect for the fact that this country had been inhabited by Aboriginal people for 50,000 years. And so people like Lunganan were really born into indentured servitude.
And to be clear for our listeners, Lunganan is Aboriginal.
That's right. She was an Aboriginal woman. So from an early age, she worked as a cook. She worked as a livestock hand, and she worked as a domestic servant for cattle stations in the Kimberley.
Was she paid for any of this work, could I ask?
No, they were paid in rations and paid in rations and tobacco and clothing. So you know, it was exactly as it sounds. It was largely indentured servitude. But one of the things that, so there were two things that made the cattle industry a bit different to some of the other colonial, the other ways in which the colonies spread out across Australia. And one of the things was that at least it meant that Aboriginal people could stay on their traditional lands. And that's very, very important. So one of the things that Lunganan will say very proudly is that she has lived every day of her life in her country, because the cattle industry just kind of came in and swept through and was like, well, you know, they didn't necessarily want to move people off their land. They kept them on the land because they were a good labour force. And the other thing about the Kimberley is that because the Kimberley is largely tropical, every time the wet season came through, the stations, the cattle stations or the ranches, we'd call them stations, but they were ranches, the ranches would essentially shut down. And so throughout the wet season, people like Lunganan could return to their traditional sacred sites where they would perform ceremony. And so, you know, during her life, she really, what she would say, footwalked the length and breadth of her country, and she absorbed its poetry and she learnt its lessons, and she did all of the things that her ancestors would have done for millennia, which they would call caring for country. So, you know, that really was her life. And so, you know, she was somebody who was very used to hard work. She was very used to, you know, this sort of dangerous, back-breaking work of working on a cattle ranch. And then, you know, after the 1970s, when the government legislated that you had to pay Aboriginal workers, and you know, it became the whole social fabric of the Kimberley changed, and you know, they began to use helicopters and much more specialised kind of workers. So a lot of Aboriginal people were sort of made, you know, unemployed, made redundant, I guess. And so for somebody like Lunganan, you know, who had always been very busy, I think she was really I think the opportunity to do something like start a painting career was probably very attractive to her, and it would have been attractive for two reasons. One is because, you know, she's somebody who's never been idle in her life, so it was an opportunity to continue doing meaningful work. But the second thing is that it was an opportunity for her to share this incredible knowledge that she has of her country. She's the oldest speaker of her language. It's a language that, you know, is somewhat endangered, and she holds an incredible wealth of cultural knowledge. So, you know, I think it was this amazing opportunity for her to work, but also to work doing something that you know, she felt very passionate about.
So, okay, this is one of the questions that we ask artists on the show all the time. When you start creating art, as artists, we're not exactly business-minded. So being paid for our art is always a challenge, unless we have a great following or, you know, a benefactor or something like that. So, you know, she's in her 90s. She started painting. How did her work get out of Australia and to Charlottesville, Virginia, of all places?
Right. So, you know, after the 1970s, there was an incredible boom in interest in Australia in Aboriginal art. And what happened is all around the country, these what we would call, you know, community art centres or artist studios emerged, or artist cooperatives emerged. And they, you know, it was through these artist cooperatives that an artist's work would get to the big city, Sydney or Melbourne. And so one of the reasons probably why Lungernan didn't start painting until 2004 was there wasn't an opportunity for her. There wasn't a studio. It's extremely hard for an Aboriginal person to, you know, set themselves up independently as a painter, as it is for any painter, right?
Yeah.
So Lungernan starts painting in 2004 because a new cooperative opens where she lived in Derby, called Munumbara Aboriginal Arts. And Munumbara means literally it's an elder. So it was a group of old men and women who started to paint. And her works came to the attention of a dealer in Perth called Diane Mossenson. And Diane immediately fell for Lungernan's work and agreed to show her. And then in 2004, they put together a show which had 26 of her first 30 works.
Wow.
So one of the interesting things with this show is that this show actually has the very first painting that Lungernan ever did in it. Because from the very moment that she started painting, it was clear that she was such a significant figure in the community that her paintings were going to have some kind of historical value. Mm. But what no one could have predicted, if you look at the very first work, it's very scratchy, it's very raw, it's very simplistic. What no one could have predicted is that within, you know, a matter of months that she would start refining her practice and producing these extraordinarily detailed, delicate, shimmering paintings. So in answer to your question, you know, I guess it was that a dealer in Perth spotted her work and saw the talent. But interestingly, this dealer also acted as a patron because the works in this show are all works from Diane and Dan Mossenson's private collection. So they were the ones that, you know, throughout her career that they kept for themselves.
Right.
And so, you know, they obviously kept some pretty magnificent pieces. And so when I was curating this show, I was very lucky that I was able to kind of curate it all from one collection because they really had such extraordinary pieces.
Wow.
So hold on for just a moment because I want to get back and ask you about those pieces. We have to do our station identification, and it's going to sound something like this.
Howdy, y'all. This is Zap McConnell from Chicken Bank Collective, and I am with Homegrown.
15 minutes past the hour. If you're just joining us, we're here with Henry F. Skerritt, art historian and curator, and specifically the curator who's just brought Yimarduwara, Artist of the River, to the Klugeru Aboriginal Art Collection. Henry, to talk about the nature of these paintings, I've seen pictures of them online. I don't know what I would have expected from a description of Lungunen, but certainly I didn't expect such an explosion of color and such an almost pointillistic approach. I mean, do you think that's fair to use pointillism as a comparison?
Yeah, sure. I mean, look, they're made up of lots and lots and lots of dots. So in that respect, you know, I think that's right. And actually, you know, when you say pointillism, her palette is not all that different to the classic pointillist palette either. There's lots of rich yellows and mauves and pinks and purples. So, you know, yeah, sure, that's a great comparison.
Right. Cool. And it's so many of these seem to be very abstract. Do you know anything about, or can you speak to anything about her subjects? Is she going from just an examination of color and form, or are these expressionistic representations of something specific?
Yeah, so, you know, that is a very complicated question. That's one that I've really been thinking about a lot. So maybe what we should do first is I'll just sort of describe what these paintings look like for your listeners, because what Lungunen would normally do is she would start by segmenting the canvas in, so she'd kind of grid the canvas out into, you know, maybe three or four or five kind of gridded sections, and then usually she would draw some figures, some circles or some trees, or maybe, you know, or some lines or whatever, and then she would just painstakingly dot them in. And what she would do is she would do like a line of white dots, and then she would follow that with a line of colored dots, so that you get these high contrasts, right? That there's always a light dot next to a dark dot, so that the whole thing sort of shimmers.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, yeah?
Yeah, shimmers. I think shimmers is just the right word.
Now, if you ask her what she's painting, she'll tell you, she'll say, it's Nigana country. It's her country, right? The country of the Nigana people. And then if you push her a bit harder, she'll start to say, well, this contains all of the bush tucker. Bush tucker is what Aboriginal people would refer to the bountiful fruits of the land. So she'll look at it and she'll say, well, that's Werban, the bush onion. That's Mugabulla, the bush banana. That's Bunuk, some berries that we would eat or crush into a paste. So in her paintings, she's thinking very clearly about her country. And she's thinking very clearly about the ways in which she lived off country, the kinds of fruits and yams and berries and things that they would collect as part of their hunter-gatherer lifestyle. But sometimes I think that she's doing that in a way that is more impressionistic than necessarily referential. So, you know, there have been times where I've heard her talk about a section of a canvas and say, oh, that's bush onions. And then, you know, later on she'll say, oh, actually it's bush bananas. So, you know, I think there's a certain slipperiness that sections can be abstract in the sense that they mean multiple things, not just one thing. What she will say is that she's not painting ancestral narratives, you know, which people expect from a lot of Aboriginal painting. She says these are not Narangani paintings. She's not painting the dreamings per se. She's painting her country. That's not to say that her country is not deeply infused with dreamings. It's just that's not what she's choosing to share. And partly, I guess, that's because she knows that these paintings are going to travel the world. And so she doesn't want to necessarily reveal information that would be, you know, normally kept secret. So she's very much painting her country, and she's painting her country to show that she knows that country. So when she talks about bush tucker, what she's really doing is she's creating a kind of a, what I'd say to be a synecdoche. She's using bush tucker to as a part to kind of represent a whole of the whole of hunter-gatherer knowledge of place, because that's really important, because what that says is, you know, I'm Lungunan, this is my country, and it's my country because I know this country, right? I know how to live off this country. I have a knowledge of this country that was shared with me by my parents and my grandparents. And so that's really what I think these paintings are about. And so even if you can't look at these paintings and necessarily decode them, you know, you can't necessarily look at them and tell what every icon is meant to be. What you can do is look at them and say, well, this is the record of a particular way of seeing this place. And it's a record of a particular way of seeing this place that's given to us by a woman who probably knows this place better than anybody else on the planet. And I think that's really powerful.
Yeah, that's amazing. So were you able to actually speak to her?
Yeah, I have on many, many occasions over a 5-year period. And she's amazing. Her English is not brilliant.
Right.
Her English is not brilliant, but she talks very, very passionately about her country and her paintings. She's very, you know, she's rightly proud of what she's achieved as a painter. But, you know, I'll give you one anecdote because, you know, she was in Melbourne. I was sitting in a gallery in Melbourne with her and a much younger painter who was in her 60s and named Peggy Wozzi. Now, they were being interviewed by the Australian radio, Radio National, and the interviewer was asking Peggy about one of Peggy's paintings, and Peggy was explaining that this painting was a painting of two koolamon, two wooden bowls, and they were full of berries. And she's explaining where you collect these berries and what you do with them. And Lungunan is sitting there, and she doesn't even seem to be paying any attention. But then all of a sudden, she pipes up. This really, like, this little demure, quiet lady pipes up, and she starts getting more and more animated. And Peggy, because she's much younger, defers to Lungunan. So all of a sudden, Lungunan is explaining Peggy's paintings for her and getting, like, more and more enthusiastic, more and more animated, but she's speaking entirely in Nyingma, so no one but Peggy can understand what she's saying. So there's this lady who's this deeply inward, very quiet, very demure lady, but somebody who is so passionate about her country, so passionate about traditional knowledge, but also so deeply respected by her peers that, you know, another artist will defer to her to explain her paintings. So, you know, she's an amazing old woman, Lungunan.
That's great. So, so the exhibit has 26 of her works.
Yes, maybe. So this is the second stop of this exhibition. It was previously on at the Australian Embassy in Washington, D.C., and it's traveled down here, and it's a little bit smaller in its configuration in Charlottesville just because of space. But, yeah, no, there's 26 sounds about right.
And so how long will the exhibit be open? How long can we see it? Because I'm listening to you talk about her. I have to see these. I mean, it sounds really interesting.
It is an amazing show, and I would give yourself time, even though it's a small show, you really want to spend time with these paintings because they're very dense. But it's on until August the 21st at the Kluge-Ruhr Aboriginal Art Collection.
Plenty of time. And, you know, no excuse to miss this show.
Really, yeah, sorry? There's no excuse to miss it.
No. And it's, you know, it's funny because, you know, one of the things that's really neat about Lungunan and sort of Aboriginal art in general in Australia is that here, I think when people think of a 105-year-old artist, they think of, you know, folk art and Granny Moses and these sort of things. But, you know, in a way, in Australia, Lungunan's kind of a cutting-edge contemporary artist. And at the moment in Adelaide, which is, you know, Adelaide's quite a big city in Australia, she's showing in the Adelaide Biennial of Contemporary Australian Art, where she's like, her works are holding their own in a room with painters who are 7 decades her junior. And just the strength of what she's doing is, you know, it's really powerful, it's really contemporary, and I mean, I think it's really exciting.
Wow, well, that's great. Thank you so much for your role in bringing the work down here to us, to our little town. Thank you so much for taking time on your Sunday morning for being with us. And we hope that you can join us again next time you're back in Charlottesville.
I look forward to that.
All right. Have a good day, Henry. All right. 25 minutes past the hour. And let's look at some other things coming up in this artistic town of ours. Today's the last day for the Great American Trailer Park Musical at Four County Players. People have been loving this show. I don't know if today's show is sold out yet. Contact Four County and see. Currently running now at the New City Arts Initiative Gallery at WVTF and Radio IQ Studios. It's Annie Temmink's Hat Shapes. Hats and drawings by Annie Temmink. Gallery hours are by appointment. Also another one from New City Arts down at their open gallery. Down in another gallery. Currently running till May 27th, Flower Till Death Do We Part. Prints and paintings by local artist Hannah Barefoot at the Welcome Gallery. That's what it is. Not the open gallery, but the Welcome Gallery. I'll get there eventually. Currently running now until May 29th, Raptors paintings by Cynthia Burke at McGuffey Art Center. Just have a few days to catch those last ones. And currently running until May 25th, open submission by writers and directors for this year's Guerrilla Theater's Summer Shorts. You just have a few days left to submit either plays or your bid to direct plays for Guerrilla Theater's Summer Shorts coming up. Playing on May 24th, the Virginia Film Festival and The Violent Crown present VFF at the Violent Crown film series In the Shadow of Women at 7:30. French filmmaker Philippe Garrel's close look at the complex nature of infidelity and specifically the unique way that infidelity is experienced and processed by men and women. May 27th, Bent Theater Improv at the Bridge PAI at 8 p.m. And this is just some of the musical options that we have available to us. Tomorrow, Jazz Society Artist Educator Series presents from P.F. DePorter with singer Pauline at the Tin Whistle Irish Pub. Michael 25th, Michael Clem at Glasshouse Winery. Also May 25th, local jazz fusion supergroup Quiet Fire at the Bebedero. May 26th, the Michael Ellswick Gathering at Fellini's. I know what you're saying. Is there only jazz going on? Sue me. I like jazz. But for you non-jazz people, May 27th, the Chickenhead Blues Band at Fridays After 5. Also on the 27th, the Pollux at Glasshouse Winery. And Super Unknown with Pale Blue Dot at the Anteroom. And our man who was just here on May 27th, David Tewksbury, the David Tewksbury Band at Fellini's. Coming off of his recent CD release, May 28th, LG, standing for Leslie Gourdet, bassist for the Porch Cats. He's got a group called LG and Friends playing at the Whiskey Jar. Also on the 28th, the Ragged Mountain String Band at Albemarle Cider Works. And Spidel, Goodrich, Goggin, and Lyle at the Batesville Market. Also on May 28th, the Robert Joss Bay Express. Okay, I got one more jazz thing in. Sue me. I can go for weeks without saying a jazz thing, but so much jazz going on right now. The Robert Joss Bay Jazz Express at Fellini's. And, of course, every Monday, it's the Singer-Songwriter Night at the Local. Every Tuesday, traditional Irish session at the Tin Whistle Pub. Wednesday is a cherry day. It's the open mic night at Pro Renata Farm Brewery. Bob Bonetta at Cafe Couture. The Mike Rosensky and Jeff Decker Quartet at Miller's. And, of course, Jim Wave at Blue Moon Diner. And every Thursday is the Woolen Writers Revival, hosted by Will Thomas Reed and Brian Craddock at Firefly. And if that's not to your liking, head on down to the Downtown Mall in Miller's to catch the John Dearth Quintet, because every once in a while you just got to come down to Dearth. And that is just some of the wonderful artistic options in our wonderfully artistic town. If you are an artist and have an event coming up, we would like to tell people about it. So tell us so we can tell them. Contact us at our Facebook page, www.facebook.com/homegrownwpvc, or you can email at us at our handy-dandy email address, homegrown947@gmail.com.
And you know what, guys? You can also email us if you want to be on the show.
That's true.
You know, I mean, you know, you got something to talk about? Come on, send us an email. We are happy to have you. We love to talk to y'all.
Artists, this is a show for you, for us, for all of us. 30 minutes past the hour. You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, and it's Homegrown, a show about local art. Make sure you stay tuned, whether you're listening to us live or listening to us streaming live on our website.
How cool is that? We're streaming, Clinton.
We're so streaming.
We are streaming.
Usually at this time of the morning, I'm just screaming. But on Sundays, I'm streaming.
The wonders of technology. What technology has done for your life?
Yeah, I'm saying. Stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call with Rick Moore. Today, Rick the man is going to be talking to folks from the local food banks discussing hunger and poverty, two things that I'm sure never go together in this abundant town of ours.
In this little hamlet.
In this place that so many bougie magazines say is one of the best places in the world to live.
In the world to live, right?
I hear we have nice golf courses.
We're like, you know, like one or two on every single one of those lists that come out.
I'm saying.
Yeah.
Can't have hunger and poverty in one of the best places in the world to live. Come on.
No.
Come on. Rick Moore, what are you doing to us? What are you saying?
He is ruining our what's the word I'm looking for?
Aboriginal?
Yeah. I think we broke the rule of not using the word. I think we used it a lot.
It was just it was there.
It was there.
It was there.
And we had to do it.
We had to. All right, time for our next guest. All right, so we are here with our next guest. Speaking of our next guest comes all the way from our good old friends at Four County Players. How's it going, Ed?
It's going well. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for coming. Ed Warwick White from Four County Players, and you're here to talk about something. What could Four County be here to talk? Because we just had people on.
I know, right? What is that?
Yeah, it's like, it's because they were talking about a show.
It's because we love them, that's why.
Aww.
You guys don't have more shows, do you?
No, never. No.
I didn't think so.
Edward is tired. He's done.
Exactly. We're closed. No, I'm just kidding. No, for no, folks, we're not. No, just
you didn't come. You don't get us ever again.
You missed it. No, just
so what are you here to talk to us about, Edward?
I'm here. I'm very excited to be talking about our 44th season in Barboursville, Virginia, coming
Holy
up.
Holy smokes. So Four County Players, which advertises itself as the longest running community theater in Central Virginia.
That is correct.
Is it actually the longest running community theater in Virginia? Do we know?
It's not. It's the longest continually running theater in Central Virginia. So I think there might be some out there who like have, you know, opened and then taken breaks and come back and things like that. But we have been running straight and steady for 44 years in Central Virginia.
That's amazing.
That's a lot of shows. That's a lot of seasons.
Oh, my God. The repertoire that you guys have amassed must be amazing.
And we actually keep it on our website. There's a full list of all of the shows. It's crazy.
OK, now I'm going to go look at that just for giggles.
There you go.
You won't see all of them. There was a short show that I did that was Richard Nixon on Broadway, and it was just they expunged all history of that.
Deleted the folder and hid the box.
I just want to say it seemed like a good idea at the time.
We've had a few of those. We're like, back, you're like, what?
That seems to be a theme with you. Things seeming to be good in the moment, but not so much.
I'm all about the moment, baby.
Oh, my God.
I'm all about the moment.
I love it.
Consequences for suckers.
But he gets it so wrong so often. So anyway, Edward.
Hi.
Don't mind us. We're just an old married theater couple.
I love it. That's how it should be.
So what is in the 44th season?
We are super excited. I think it's a great season. One of the things we were really trying to do this year, it's been a big year on sort of surveying our audiences, surveying our actors, getting a lot of good feedback. We're in the middle of a capital campaign where we're sort of taking a look at all of our backstage spaces for our actors and production teams. And we did the same thing for our audiences and our actors, put together a big survey this season to say, hey, what do you want to see? Like, what do you want to be a part of? Because that's the whole thing. You want shows that directors want to direct. You want shows that actors want to be in. What are those bucket list shows? What are the shows that costume designers want to really get their hands on? And that's what we've tried to put together, and put together a really good season that appeals to a lot of different folks and a lot of different talents.
That's nice. That's really nice. So what kind of feedback did you get from this?
So we got a good mix. So we, try to always have, enough folks, because here's the thing, you have a lot of different actors who, your folks who do a Shakespeare play may not be your folks who are going to do a big, musical. So you want to have things that are going to appeal to a lot of different talents.
What?
Sometimes.
I've done a Shakespeare play, and I did that Nixon on Broadway thing. That was...
You're the exception.
We are so
you're the beautiful exception.
We are not talking about you, okay?
I still think that I'm Not a Crook number could have worked. If I had two more ducks, it would have ended.
And the big 11th hour Watergate, dance number. That was everybody's favorite.
That's the big number in the show, right?
That was it.
Watergate, really. I thought it should have water. And,
oh, my God.
And swimming. Anyway, but...
Please be quiet.
All right.
So, Edward, please continue.
So what goes into? So, I want to hold off on actual list. I want to tantalize our listeners. So, what goes into choosing a season? And here's another question that I'm sure people have: who chooses the season?
Yeah, absolutely. So, what goes into choosing a season? We have a large submission period. So, for example, we're about to put on season 44, starting this August, I want to believe. We will
still
open
just season 44.
Season 44. I know, I keep saying that. We will open up for submissions. And so that's a time where directors can submit shows that they're interested in directing. It could also be, if it's a local playwright who's written something and says, hey, I'd love for you to read this script, whether it's attached to a director or not. And then there is an actual programming committee. So we're a volunteer organization. We have sort of a theater operations director who runs the physical building and the box office and sort of keeps the old ship, sailing. And then everybody else are volunteers on a board of directors. And then we have a program.
So that's great. So like one employee, everything else.
So from the paint on the set to, the bathrooms to the marketing, that's sort of my big areas. I market a lot of the shows and sort of put together, sort of all of those packages. But everything else. So we have a production manager, and that individual sort of oversees all of the shows from, beginning from the minute they're picked to getting the show staffed with designers, to getting auditions run, to getting them closed and getting the feedback afterward. So the programming committee is chaired by our production manager, and then it is an ever-changing committee of board members, as well as some we usually have a couple non-board members as well, folks who aren't kind of involved in the day-to-day running of the theater, who are a part of that group, and they take the submissions and this year take the feedback from the survey and try to put together a well-balanced season. Shows that are going to have opportunities for young people. We're always excited to get our young folks on the stage.
Absolutely.
Because I actually just got went and saw some of the shows this spring, saw Hairspray at AHS, and I'm just continuing really blown away by the talent of the young folks in our community. So those chances we have to...
Yeah, I missed that. How was that?
Oh, it was great. I mean, I love that show to begin with, but just watching you forget these kids are like, have limited time to put it together, and that they're in high school and even younger.
And have the time to manage, their teenage schedules and do a show. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Honestly, I don't see how you do Hairspray without high schoolers, because Hairspray just take this certain level of sheer manic energy through the whole thing?
No, it totally does. And it was one of those things where it was like at the very end, like you forgot how many people were in it, and then like all 100 of them like bum rush the stage, and you're just like,
oh my God,
are we under attack? But you're also like, you can't help but smile, because it's just amazing and they're having the time of their lives. So really having opportunities for our young people, having opportunities for the folks who are singers and non-singers and dancers and you know, different skill sets on design teams, because, you know, you got some.
But not to leave this too soon, it's really important for Four County to have opportunities for young people, because that's really deeply embedded in the organization, because you guys have that scholarship thing going.
We do, right? we do. So we have the Four County Founder Scholarship Program. So all of our, we have a bistro, which is sort of our snack bar, your popcorn, your beer, your wine, candy. So all the proceeds from the bistro at Four County go to an annual scholarship fund where we give anywhere between 1 to 5 scholarships for rising, graduating high school, going into college students to help support their academic pursuits, especially those who are going into theater at the college level, which is exciting. We offer our summer camps in the summer. We've got 2 this summer, like a summer theater intensive where folks are actually putting on a production of Peter Pan. And then we have our and then we have a second camp, which is sort of our more traditional to get all the sort of budding thespians and young designers and actors and singers together, and they go through stage combat and musical theater and dancing and storytelling and improv and sort of all those foundational elements of theater. So you get like the really little ones all the way to the folks who sort of have their roots. I know.
That's so precious.
Cute. I know. So we love that, being able to find opportunities for them, and you end up with those great shows that whole families can be in, but then you've got the ones that are, you know, darker and edgier as well, which is fun.
Do you ever have a problem balancing it all? I imagine so. I mean, there's got to be a point where you're like, well, we need to have this comedy, we need to have this, we need to have this, but we don't have, what about a dark, edgy comedy that kids can have that's family friendly, but also talks about somebody dying from heroin?
I know, I'm like, have we written that one yet?
Oh my God.
That should be the goal, put it all in one show. Like, it's like a musical.
And it's a farce.
A dark family musical farce with elements of Shakespeare and, you know.
Clinton and I, we need to write that.
A dark family-friendly Shakespearean farce about somebody dying from heroin.
Yeah, exactly. And that's something that some folks might not know, is that, you know, we're out at the old schoolhouse in Barbersville, and we actually have 2 different spaces, which could be more different. Clinton, I know you know this, having recently been on the boards with us, but we have a cellar space, which is our black box, so more experimental. We try to do sort of the edgier, darker shows. We even do some musical cabarets down there, but things that lend themselves to that sort of intimate audience, you know, seats between 60 and 70 people. The space can be reconfigured, and we can get away with some of those more, you know, touchy subjects, language, things like that. Although, you know, Trailer Park on the Main Stage. But
Trailer Park on the Main Stage.
Exactly. If you saw that or not. And
yes.
And then we have our actual traditional 200-seat proscenium theater upstairs with the velvet curtains, and that's where you're going to see more of your musicals and your larger plays and sort of more family-friendly, you know, more hopefully more better known shows as well. But we blur those lines too sometimes.
So do you guys program for both spaces all at once right at the beginning of the year?
We do. We try to leave some flexibility in the calendar for things to come up, just because we don't want to be so programmed to the point that if something really exciting were to emerge, like a one weekend opportunity, somebody says, hey, I'd love to do like a staged reading of the show, or what if we had like a 1 or 2 night, you know, thing with like a singer-songwriter night or something, or a concert or a magic show, or, you know, you just want to leave some space for things to happen and things to, it's a living, breathing, you know, thing.
So. Clinton does magic.
I like it.
I do.
Clinton does magic.
It is a magical thing for me to do the show every week.
Aww, you hear that, folks? There's a lot of love in here.
Yeah. He's buttering me up for something. There'll be a sting later on.
Right.
Trust me.
It's coming. We'll wait for it.
Yeah, later on I get sawed in half. That's
and he may or may not be put back together, folks. I'm just saying.
There you go.
Great. Hey, so let's have audience participation time. Everyone out there in Radio Land, turn around, look at a clock, or maybe take out your phones, look at the clock on the phone, see that? You see the clock? See the time? It's that many minutes past the hour. You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. If you're just joining us, we are here with Ed Warwick White from Four County Players, from the board of Four County Players, and we're talking about their upcoming season. And which number season is that?
44.
The 44th season upcoming from Four County Players.
All right, so I think it's time.
Is it time?
I think it's time.
Have we tempted them enough?
We've tempted them enough.
Just one. So how hard was it to choose this season?
It is hard. I mean, it is a challenge. We had a ton of wonderful submissions. There ends up being a lot of the hey, like, this didn't quite fit at this time, but please resubmit next season. You know, please keep us.
Yeah, I had one of those.
We love you.
Were there fights? Were words said?
It's usually a very positive group and experience, just trying to find the right mix at the right time. And like we said, like I know this past season we did some experimenting. We did sort of a non-holiday show at our traditional holiday slot. We did the Great American Trailer Park Musical in the spring when we normally do a kind of traditional stage play. So we try some things and then we try again and see what makes most sense.
All right. So here on Homegrown, for all of you who can't just simply go to Google and check out the Ford County website.
Don't tell them that.
Here is Ford County Players 44th season.
Awesome. Well, we are very excited. We are kicking things off this summer with our summer musical, which is Once on This Island.
Woo!
Awesome. That's going to be July 22nd through August 7th on the main stage. Very excited. Have a great production team, a wonderful cast. It's a fun, colorful musical with great sort of Caribbean calypso music. It has elements of Romeo and Juliet and The Little Mermaid, and it kind of tells the strong, powerful story of a peasant girl who uses the power of love to bring together people of different social classes. So a great message.
Power of love.
The power of, I don't know, Huey Lewis in the news.
And that's an OK cue. I can live with that. That's awesome.
Done. That song's actually not in the show, but it's a wonderful, wonderful show. We have a great, diverse cast. The music is one of the things that I love about the show also is because, like, for example, with Trailer Park Musical, that sort of delved more into, like, honky-tonk, rockabilly music, which is not what you get in a lot of musicals, and same thing with Once on This Island. I think it's going to be a different musical style for a lot of folks, different style for the choreography.
Yeah.
And I think that's great. It can't all be just big Busby Berkeley, like, da-da-da-da-da, you know, sort of thing, so...
It was gonna work in the Watergate number. I know.
I don't think we had the cellar then. We should bring you back for an intimate weekend in the cellar with Nixon, and that'd be great. Awesome. So we're going to move on from the summer. We will actually be heading downstairs into the cellar for Bullet for Unaccompanied Heart. That's written by local playwright Robert Ray.
We love him.
I know. Directed by Marty Moore. That's going to be October 7th through 23rd, 2016. So that is a great show. I don't know. I believe it went to Brooklyn Fringe or New York.
New York Fringe.
Awesome. Yeah. Directed by Marty there. This will be with an open casting call. So it'll be, you know, brand new for folks. Some folks may have seen it in some stage readings and things around the area, but we're excited. It's a dark comedy about a blues guitarist who's taken hostage by the ghost of his former lover.
Oh, wow.
I know, right? So there you go.
I think we've all had that experience.
We have.
Really. Who hasn't?
You're playing your guitar and the next thing you know.
Seriously, is there any blues guitarist who isn't really the hostage
isn't that what being a blues guitarist that's sort of a requirement of, you know,
exactly
applying to be a blues guitarist. So we are super excited to be featuring the work of a local playwright in that space, which is great.
Well done. Bravo.
Awesome. And then we're moving upstairs for the opposite of Bullet for Unaccompanied Heart for a Charlie Brown Christmas on the main stage. I know. Christmas time is here. Exactly.
That's awesome.
So that's going to be, I know, and that's in there. So this is November.
This is, believe it or not,
this is November 18th to December 11th, directed by Jane Gargett, musical direction by Jim Niederberger, and this is a faithful stage adaptation of the holiday TV special. So they have...
Oh my God, they did a stage adaptation of Charlie Brown Christmas.
Eric Schaefer, folks have heard of Eric Schaefer up from Signature Theater and Arlington, Broadway director, wrote an adaptation. So this brings the TV classic to the stage.
So I just want to get this
straight. Talking like
you're telling me that someone is going to be able to stand on stage, have that moment of silence, and turn around and say, like, that's the real meaning of Christmas.
Yes, Linus is going to get that.
Off.
I know, and there's not going to be a dry eye in the house, I hope. So we're going to bring that classic cartoon feel, the great Vince Guaraldi, you know, music, the ice skating, all of it, the great Linus and Lucy Peanuts dance where they come in the auditorium and all the kids are breaking it down.
Yes!
So practice your Peanuts dance moves. That's going to be the dance call. But we're excited. We love to celebrate. We've been celebrating 44 holidays out at Barbersville. So this will be a great family-friendly show. One of those great ones after you go pick up the Christmas tree or go to church or do whatever to come out and enjoy the show.
It's a Christmas miracle. You've actually found a Christmas show that we're excited about.
Yeah, I mean, because there aren't that many. I mean, that's the thing. That's why we kind of experimented this last season, is because you can only do It's a Wonderful Life so many times. You can only do Christmas Carol so many times, and we love those. We just have to break up the times that we do those. So we're really excited. It's more of a play with music, so not a ton of musical numbers, but the ones you're used to, like Christmas Time Is Here and stuff like that, will be in there. So woo. And then after we celebrate Christmas, hopefully it won't snow, and we will move downstairs again to the cellar. This is a special, sort of a special event. I'll still call it a show, but we are doing A.R. Gurney's Love Letters, directed by Linda Zuby.
Oh my God.
February 3rd through 12th. I believe that's two weekends. And the thing that we're excited about this is, so Love Letters is a story of, two friends from childhood that grow up, live very different lives, and they look back at their sort of 50-year relationship.
And it's heartbreaking.
And they read it through the love letters they wrote to each other. And the thing that we're really excited about is we are, something we've never really done before. We're featuring a real life couple in this show, Ken Waller and Linda Poser, if you've seen either of them. So they are, sort of a local couple. They had a long career in New York. Ken was in Phantom of the Opera for like 20 years, which is like unheard of. They met doing theater, and so they have this beautiful love story themselves, and have been a big part of our theater community. So we're sort of treating it as a special event where it will be the Wallers doing love letters, so sort of real life love story telling another love story.
See, whenever you have a real couple on stage, it's nail biting. You're not allowed to break up during this show.
Right. Exactly. Well, and that's funny because the idea actually came because, you know, with both of them having done shows at the theater for so long, they have all of these wonderful stories about their real life and their times in New York and just these things you wouldn't believe. And like, somebody has to write these down and do their own version, like the Wallers love letters. So we're so excited to have them do this and share this show with folks. And it was recently back on Broadway, and they featured different kind of celebrity, not couples, but like it was like Brian Dennehy and Carol Burnett and like Alan Alda and like someone else, like Candace Bergen, and they rotated.
Yeah.
Which is a really kind of neat idea.
Love Letters is one of my absolute most favorite plays of all time.
It's wonderful.
I directed it when I was in college.
That's awesome.
I did not know that.
Yeah. I loved it. Little shout out to my buddy David Gerson, who played the male lead. Awesome.
What's next?
That's awesome. No, nothing. No, I'm just kidding. So then, that's it. On that note, we like lovely. So we are actually moving back up. So you're getting this back up and down. So it's going to be a lot of upstairs, downstairs sort of action. So wear your Fitbits. So we're heading up. We are heading upstairs for our spring musical, which is Chicago.
Holy smokes. That's a little randy
to the Windy City. Book by Fred Ebb and Bob Fosse, music by John Kander, lyrics by Fred Ebb. So Kander and Ebb, that classic Fosse choreography, directed by this real jerk, Ed Warwick White.
He's awful. He is terrible.
He's like a taskmaster. He's so mean to his actors. I don't know
what moist stone he formed under, but he's just, you know, he is rude and a half.
Moist stone. I love it.
Musical direction by Kristen Baltus. You've probably seen Kristen work on a lot of local shows. Woo. Vocal direction by Kate Lambert. Choreography by Heather Powell of the Arden School of Performing Arts. She's done a lot of choreography around. I know.
I love Kate.
You want to talk about a taskmaster.
Oh, I know.
We love her for that.
I've known her since her UVA days. Oh, yeah. Trust me, we worked right down the hall from each other.
She gets good work out of people.
You do not mess with Kate. No. I'm telling you.
No. So, you know, Chicago classic musical, love, greed, sex, murder, all the things we hold dear and near to our hearts. But story of a woman who desperately wants to be a star and is on trial for murder of her husband, and it's all told through musical vaudeville. So different performance, great show for dancers. So folks, if you love to dance, love to sing, please come out and deal with the director, who's fine. Really handsome, though. No,
he is devilishly handsome.
All right, and then we're going back downstairs. Try to imagine it. Up and down, up and down. So this is really exciting for us. So we have
sound effect of going back downstairs.
There you go. I like it. So speaking of our young people, which is not Chicago, we do what we call the Teen Arts Project TAP out at Fort County, and this is a program. So this is a show fully put on by teens, casted by teens, directed by teens. It has some sort of adult membership from folks who are involved with the theater, but this is called Dancing with Myself. It is a play by Leanne Griffin, and this was actually pitched to us by a teenager who applied to direct. Her name is Jessica Harris. She is wonderful. You might have seen her on stage in some different shows. And this will be April 7th through 9th, 2017. So it'll be directed by a teen. It'll be a cast of teens. I want to say it's seven high school girls will be the actors. And it sort of tells the story of seven high school friends who come together. And it's sort of about pushing through the labels they've been forced to wear in high school and develop their own unique identity. So like the nerd, the jock, the cheerleader, sort of all of those high school labels we get very quickly, whether we want them or not, and how we sort of navigate those tricky waters.
Amen, brother.
I know, exactly. It's like we can tell a whole story about it.
Yes.
High school was hard.
We'll talk later.
Exactly. One thing I didn't say, sorry, Chicago's March 3rd through 26th. So that's March, and then April 7th through 9th, 2017 is the Teen Arts Project with Dancing with Myself. And then we are going to wrap things up, guess where? Upstairs for the season. So we'll be back about where we are right now. And we like to close out our season with a wonderful, well-known stage play, and this is Noel Coward's Blithe Spirit.
Little coward.
A little Noel Coward on the main stage, directed by Millie Murray Susan. And that's May 5th through the 21st, 2017. So that tells the story of when a sort of seance goes awry and brings up a gentleman named Charles, his first wife, is conjured, and she decides to wreak some trouble and havoc in his current marriage. So we get a little battle of the ghost of the ex-wife and the current wife.
Charles wouldn't be a blues player.
No, right. See, you know, our theme this season is ghosts. And,
I'm always like, what seance doesn't go awry?
I know, right? Yeah, like what is the definition of that goes well? Like,
because right?
It's like, because I've seen Long Island Medium, and I'm kind of like,
right?
I'm like, you know, it's like, yeah.
Oh,
so,
my goodness.
So I think this probably takes more of a comedic classic approach to that. But great show for actors. Miller is wonderful. She's directed for us before, last time being Little Women a couple seasons ago. And so we're very excited to have her back. And that will sort of round us out. So as you can see, hopefully a good mix for our actors, our musical theater folks, our dancers, our singers, different ages. And that is season 44.
We cannot wait. Edward, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me. Oh my gosh, it was a blast.
We love you.
We love you.
Edward White, Four County Players. You heard it. Homegrown. Now you know.
All right. Well, you know, we had so much fun talking with Edward.
So much fun.
And Henry, that we don't have time for a rant today.
We are timed out.
We are timed out. And are you happy about that, Clinton?
I'm just happy that we had so much fun.
I know, right? We had two really great guests today. I think we added a little to the fabric of Charlottesville art today.
There you go.
Like, you know, they learned a little something. They got to laugh a little bit. Like, this has been a good show, right?
We should end the show here.
Right. I think we're done.
This should be it.
Yeah. This is it.
Go out on a high note.
Right. Exactly. Leave them wanting more. We want to thank our guest, Henry F. Skerritt, the art historian and curator from the University of Pittsburgh for, I'm not going to get this right.
No, let me do it.
Okay, he can do it.
Yemar Duara.
Artist of the River. Please go see it. It's up at the Kluge-Ruh Aboriginal Art Museum until August 21st. And of course, we want to thank our buddy, our pal, that big ball of love, Edward Warwick White.
Big Ed!
For Four County Players to talk about the 44th season. Clinton, I think there are a couple of things we need to audition for.
I didn't hear any black plays.
How great would you be as Linus? That would be amazing. Come on.
Christmas time is here.
Yes, that's awesome. All right, we want to thank our guests for having fun with us, and we will see you guys next week.
Stay tuned for Sunday Morning Wake Up Call.
WPVC LP Charlottesville. You can contact the show on Facebook by searching Homegrown Charlottesville. Be sure to tune in again next Sunday at 10 for Homegrown, only on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville.